WFAE streaming is sponsored by Corporate Information Technologies, a local IT company assisting business and taking a proactive approach to technology. CIT, let us show you how good IT can be. corp-infotech.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. There is something about Mars that has fascinated man almost since the beginning of time. But it is only recently that we've been able to get a close-up look at the red planet. We've sent a number of space probes to the surface, but none as ambitious as the current one. The Mars rover Curiosity has been on the planet for just a short while after spending months in space and executing a flawless, one-of-a-kind landing. Its mission? To find evidence of life. It took hundreds, if not thousands, of people to design the spacecraft, the mission, and the tools with which to do the job. And one of those people is with us today. Dr. Dawn Sumner is a geobiologist in the Department of Geology at the University of California, Davis. Dr. Sumner is a member of the Mars Exploration Program Advisory Group, a co-investigator for the Mars Science Laboratory camera team, and one of the long-term planners for the mission. And she joins us for the hour. Welcome to Charlotte. Nice to have you with us.
Thanks for inviting me.
You have worn and continue to wear evidently many hats with this Mars rover project, including co-chairing the Landing Site Working Group. I take it that means you helped choose the place it landed.
Yeah, so one of the great things about a mission like this is you bring together all sorts of people with different expertise, and that the landing site selection was one of those. So the working group coordinated a lot of the work looking at data from orbiters around Mars to try to figure out what is the best place to send Curiosity to do the best science.
And what criteria did you look for? How did you choose the site?
Well, the first thing is we have to land safely. If the rover crashes, we get no science. And so people from the community who work on Mars proposed over 50 landing sites, and the community decided which are the best dozen or so of those. And then the engineers evaluated whether they're safe, and we kept narrowing it down to sites where we could land and sites that were scientifically interesting. And we have to actually be able to use the tools on the rover effectively to get the best science. So there's always this trade-off between the engineering and the place a geologist would want to go.
Yeah, so who won?
The scientists all won. So for the first time ever in the history of going to Mars, our four favorite scientific sites were all safe to land. The engineering team that designed the lander did such a good job at improving the landing system that we actually had a scientific choice. And within those four sites, there were pluses and minuses for all of them, and they were all good. And we ended up choosing Gale Crater because all of the instrument teams could see how they could use their instruments to do some really interesting science investigations there.
When did it actually land? I've forgotten when it actually landed.
August 6th. Late at night.
But I do remember that the day it was going to land and the days leading up to the landing, there was a lot of press coverage on the remarkable way that the thing was going to land and how it had never been done. They didn't know if it was going to work. Millions of dollars were at stake here. What was going through your mind as you knew it was landing? Because Mars is 14 minutes in communication time away from Earth. You didn't know for 14 minutes whether it had gotten down safely. What was going through your mind?
So I had talked to a lot of the engineers, and even though the landing system looked really scary, the engineers were confident that it would work because there's a lot of engineering heritage from helicopters moving large equipment that they used for this landing system. So I'm an optimist, and so I also believe the engineering team that designed the system. And so I had a lot of confidence we would land safely, but when you actually watch the data coming back and you think about those 14 minutes and the rover is either on the ground or it's crashed by the time you get that information, it was just thrilling.
You know, this to me is the whole reason for the space program. This is astounding what we can do. The idea that you can launch something off this planet and put it on a trajectory that will get it at a certain point in time, at a certain place elsewhere in the solar system, and put this thing down on a dime is astounding. Do you think people out there really appreciate that?
I think people get a sense of it. So to get it to Mars is a physics calculation. It's gravity. It's where the planets are. And it takes various observations and then you calculate it mathematically. And we had to choose the landing site fairly early before the rover launched so that they could launch it into the exact physics trajectory to get it to go into the Mars atmosphere at the right spot. And this is the first time the engineering team has actually managed to get the rover precisely in the Mars atmosphere, because we've learned so much from the past missions. And that's what allowed us to actually land inside a crater safely,
yeah.
Very precisely.
Back in the day when all these calculations were done with a slide rule and a blackboard and a piece of chalk, I suppose it's even more astounding. But today, is it all done by computers, or are human beings involved in these calculations still?
Well, so human beings are involved because they have to write the computer programs to calculate the trajectories, and they have to evaluate the results, and they have to tell, okay, our calculations are giving something we don't expect. Is there something wrong with the computer program, or is there something we don't understand, or is this the way it really is? And so there were millions of simulations of the rover going into the atmosphere and landing, and once they got the simulations right, they realized that the landing system was much more precise than they were expecting. And so they actually narrowed down the size of the landing ellipse just a few months before landing because of all these simulations. So the people use a computer like they used to use a slide rule, but allows them to do much more complicated, interesting things.
Dr. Don Sumner is a geobiologist in the Department of Geology at the University of California, Davis, and a member of the Mars Exploration Program Advisory Group. You looked at several different sites, as you've said, but you're a geobiologist, and I'm assuming that you were looking for sites that would be both geologically significant as well as holding the potential for the discovery of evidence of life on Mars. How could you determine that from so far away?
So we can't determine whether or not there's a spot with evidence of life, particularly since we don't know if life ever existed on Mars. And even when we look at Earth's fossil record, where we know we've had life for billions of years, many of the rocks contain only very faint hints of that life. But the way we look for life on early Earth is we look for rocks that form in rivers and lakes and oceans, and they accumulate the sand and mud over time. And those rocks can capture the remains or traces of organisms that lived in those environments. And so one of the reasons we really liked Gale Crater is that there are a whole series of layers of rocks, sort of like you see in the Grand Canyon. And each one of those layers was deposited in an environment that was present in that crater. And so we can go through the layers, and it's like reading a history book. Each layer represents an episode in the history of Gale Crater. So if life was present, and if the environments were right, and if it's well preserved, there's a chance we could see traces of that life in those rocks. We don't know whether or not life was present. So it's the question of how do you do good science when you're looking for something that might not exist.
This is your first mission with NASA. How did you become involved?
I first became involved with my expertise of looking for traces of life on early Earth. And so I worked with another geobiologist with the whole Mars community to describe how we would actually look for evidence of life on Mars. And we put that together in what we called the MEPAG goals documents, the Mars Exploration Program, view of how we would search for life on Mars. And that's about the time that this mission goals were first forming. And so one of the goals is to understand whether or not life could have existed in the environment. And that's one of the things that I helped coordinate as one of the science goals for looking for evidence of life.
I'm looking at your face as you talk about this. And aside from the smile, which is probably evident in your voice on the radio. People can't see your eyes. You're like a kid in a candy store with this project, aren't you?
I am, and I'm actually that way with a lot of science. But there's something that is just absolutely captivating about interacting with a rover on another planet, looking for something that is so important to people. Are we alone in the universe? Is there life somewhere else? And Mars is the place we can start to ask those questions. And it's a huge adventure. It's like being an explorer on another planet, but I get to sit here and talk to you guys.
Why Mars? Why not Venus? Why not a search for life on the moon? Could there have been life on the moon if there was life on Mars? Why not Jupiter? Why not Saturn?
So the way we understand life on Earth is that it needs several things, one of which is water. And it's possible that there is life in the universe that doesn't need water. But as a scientist, you need to make predictions about what you would find so you can actually follow up and investigate those. And so Venus is too hot to have liquid water. The moon is very dry. Right now, Mars is too cold to have liquid water at the surface, but you can see ancient canyons and river channels that suggest that water once flowed on the surface of Mars. And so we went to a place where we don't think that modern life is likely to be living if there was life on Mars. But we do think that there used to be flowing water there. So, for example, we see a river canyon that was probably created by flowing water. And so that's one of the things that we can look for on Mars.
You know, I've been to the movies, and I've seen Alien and Star Trek and Star Wars, and I know that alien life doesn't necessarily look like life on Earth. So I'm being tongue-in-cheek here, please. I hope you know that. But how do you know that when you find something, you're not looking at it and not realizing that it's evidence of life because it doesn't look like life on Earth?
Right. So that's a really interesting problem that you have to keep an open mind with the science, your science questions to address. And it is possible that we could see life and not recognize it. So we know a lot about how physical processes work and chemical processes work in the absence of life. And so what we are trying to do is look for things that don't fit those models. Mm-hmm. And when we see something that doesn't fit the model, we ask, okay, is there some chemical process I'm not imagining that would happen without life that could make this? And so if there is something that's related to life that we don't recognize, it will be very difficult for us to prove that it is evidence of life to ourselves. And it's a little bit of an iterative, uncertain process, but we are learning a whole lot about how planets work, how environments work, even if we don't understand everything that we're seeing.
You've written that there are innumerable interesting scientific questions one can ask about Mars, ranging from how it formed to how it has changed through time geologically to how it has changed through time climatically to the potential existence of life. In 30 seconds, which of those to you is the most important or intriguing question to find an answer to?
I would really like to know whether or not there was ever life on Mars. So one of the questions that I think human beings have always asked is, what is our place in the universe? And there's so many stories about the stars and the sun that understanding life is just fantastic.
And we'll explore that some more as we go through the hour with Dr. Dawn Sumner. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Ivy, a memory care day center for seniors with Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and other conditions. A place for friendship, healthy living, and medical assistance during the day, promoting independence and the comfort of returning home at night. Details at theivey.com. Coming up on Monday on this program, the mid-20th century saw the birth of home designs characterized by simple lines and open floor plans. Think Frank Lloyd Wright and Richard Neutra. Some say those once modern homes are now outdated, but since Richard Neutra's death, his son Dion has been working to preserve those homes and advocating for their place in architectural history. He joins us in advance of his visit to the Beckler when Charlotte Talks, Monday morning at 9 on 90.7 WFAE. This is a pre-recorded program. We won't be able to take your phone calls. It continues in a moment.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. President Obama is elected for a second term. The House stays Republican. The Senate gains two Democratic seats. And the focus turns to avoiding the fiscal cliff. The week's top national stories, what happened and why.
That's the Diane Rehm Show this morning at 10 on Public Radio for the Carolinas, 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Don Sumner is our guest, a geobiologist in the Department of Geology at the University of California, Davis, and a member of the Mars Exploration Program Advisory Group, co-investigator of the Mars Science Laboratory, long-term planner for the Mars Curiosity rover mission. And with us, because the Geology Society of America's 124th annual meeting and exposition has been taking place this week here in Charlotte. One of the first questions that had to be answered was, how do you search for something in a scientifically productive way if what you are looking for might not even exist? And the answer is?
Well, you take the steps that you need to look for that interesting thing that may not exist, and you make sure that the investigations that you're doing give you information. So, for example, we're at Gale Crater. We can ask questions about the environments that were present in that crater, and they'll give us a clue as to what the temperatures were, how much water was there, were there rivers present, was it just windblown dunes and very dry. Those are the same things we need to direct our search for life, and they tell us about the climate of Mars.
Why? What can we tell from this mission about all the things you just mentioned that we can't tell from super powerful telescopes looking at the surface and from previous missions?
So you can tell a whole lot from orbiting around Mars and the telescopes. In fact, we have an orbiter that gives us really high resolutions of the surface. But you're always looking down. Mm-hmm. And when you look at rocks sideways as a landscape, they look really different. You get different information. It's like the difference of looking down at Google Earth and then turning it sideways for the 3D view.
For the street view, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you get these different clues. And so when water flows over the surface, it makes ripples and leaves sand and mud in certain patterns. And you can see some of those patterns from above. But really, if you look in the direction the water flowed, you see different patterns. So you can tell, oh, this water was actually flowing quite quickly.
But is there weather on Mars?
There is, and we actually have a Twitter feed with a daily weather report.
So if there's weather, that means there's wind. Doesn't mean that there's rain because there's no water, but there is wind, right?
Yes, there is.
So if there's wind, and this is just a rocky, barren surface, why wouldn't the wind have destroyed all evidence of ripples and streams and flowing things that occurred millennia ago?
So the wind can pick up small grains and move them. And when those grains hit rocks, they abrade the rock. So the wind does destroy some of the rock, but it also does us a huge favor in that it takes layers of rocks and removes part of them, which gives us a good view of what's inside. And so the area that Curiosity is in right now is a low area where the wind has scoured out some of the rocks, and that allows us to see a lot of the different layers of rocks through time. So the wind can bury and destroy rocks, but it also gives us these windows into the history of Mars by exposing those rocks.
One of the reasons we want to be there, from a scientific point of view, I'm told, is that we want to figure out how Mars formed. Can't we figure that out from how our hypotheses on how the Earth formed? Wouldn't it be almost identical?
So there are parts of it that are identical. And we have some analyses from Earth and from meteorites that tell us some of the things that happened. But our first chemical analysis of a rock on Mars with this mission gave us a composition that's a little bit unusual for Earth.
I was going to ask you, isn't it logical to assume that geologically speaking, Mars would be made of the same stuff as Earth? And you're saying that you found some interesting different things. What have you found?
Right. So we measured a rock that came from a volcano, and it has lots of extra potassium in it and a little bit less silica than normal. And we don't know why that is yet, but when you look at the composition, it tells you something about how it melted. And we already know that there's a big difference between Earth and Mars, as an Earth has what we call plate tectonics, which are their areas where part of the surface of the Earth is going down into the interior. It creates volcanoes.
And earthquakes.
And earthquakes. All those processes. On Mars, they're volcanoes, but you don't have the same motion of the surface of Mars. And so that means that the way the lava that comes up in volcanoes is produced has to be different. We don't really know how hot it is in the interior of Mars and how that works. But when you heat rocks differently to make the lava, you get different elemental compositions. And so this rock that we've analyzed that has this high potassium, the people who study the formation of volcanoes and lavas can take that and do modeling work to try to understand how hot it is inside Mars.
Are there active volcanoes?
That's actually a little bit of a debate point. So there are lava flows that look like they're fairly recent, but from what we can tell from orbit, recent can be millions of years old.
Yes.
And we haven't seen a volcano erupt.
The scientific team, as I understand it, hypothesized that they would find a clay mineral bed in the Gale crater with clay minerals intermixed with sulfates. Has that proven to be the case, or is it too early to tell?
It's too early to tell. So far, we've only done one sample with our instrument called Chemin, which gives us the mineralogy. And it is preparing to analyze another sample now. And we haven't gotten to where we've seen the clay minerals from orbit. We are very hopeful that we will be finding those minerals, but it's just a little bit too early to tell.
In the interest of full disclosure, I must say that I am a child of the 60s, and I am a major proponent of the space program. I think the worst thing that has been done is ending the manned spaceflight program in this country, and I hope that someday we reverse that decision. And I've had debates about the importance of the space program and what it has provided those of us who remain earthbound on radio and television programs for more years than I can count. And I hate to mention Tang, but Tang was one of the products that came out of the manned space program. But so did countless other things that we are completely unaware of that have absolutely, fundamentally changed our lives.
Yeah.
Among them, how you're getting this program right now, particularly if you're receiving it as a podcast. So what kinds of benefits are we likely to see out of the millions of dollars that we're spending on the exploration of Mars?
So there is one that is very, very specific to the Curiosity mission, which is hugely beneficial to people. And I mentioned the Chemin instrument that can detect minerals. Dave Blake is the principal investigator, and he designed this machine. I was talking to him the other day, and they have miniaturized this machine so you can actually take it in the field. And it turns out that one of the best uses of this is to actually look for fake drugs. Because when you put a drug, for example, an anti-malarial drug, into the machine, it has a certain pattern. It's called a diffraction pattern. And you can actually just take the pills, powder them a little, put them in the machine, and tell whether your pharmaceutical is a fake. So sometimes it might be just made out of the mineral calcium carbonate, and it gives a different pattern. So he is actually starting to arrange for the manufacture of these instruments to evaluate the quality of drugs, particularly in third world countries where there's a real problem with fake pharmaceuticals.
Is this the same, the Chem Min is mm-hmm. what you call it. Is this the same as the Chem Cam?
No, the Chem Cam is a completely different instrument. So it actually has a laser, and it vaporizes rocks at a distance. So it makes a little spark, and then the color of the light that comes off that spark tells the camera in the instrument what elements are present. And so that's a different technology that also has other uses.
Was the Chem Cam developed for the mission, or was it rethought for the mission?
So it uses a technique that people in the lab have used for quite a long time. And so whenever you take things to space, you have to miniaturize them, you have to make them low power, and you have to really optimize them for space conditions. And so the Chem Cam is an application of a technology but that's existed for some time, but it's refined it a lot.
Yes, because up until now, how big has this Chem Cam been? It's been pretty big.
Yeah, it has been. And right now there's an electronics box, a sort of a telescope, and a laser system that are all sort of strung together. So it's in pieces in different places in the rover. Mm-hmm. So it's much smaller.
It's the size of a shoebox.
Yeah.
But on Earth, up until this mission, this thing has been enormous.
Yeah.
So what implications does research that results in that kind of miniaturization mean for Earthlings in years to come? I mean, obviously, radios used to be the size of your refrigerator, and now they're so tiny they fit on the head of a pin, literally. What does this mean for us?
Well, it's a little bit difficult to project how it will change the technology. But again, if you sort of go to the importance of medical devices, you know, right now there are huge scanners, very large pieces of equipment. But when we can miniaturize them, I mean, some of the things is maybe like being able to do blood tests just on a regular basis if you need to monitor something in your body and just be able to do it at home.
Now, there will be those who say, well this kind of technology, since it can be done and has been done, would have been done for people on Earth without spending all these extra dollars on sending things out into outer space, and who gives a darn anyway. Are they right or are they wrong?
I think that you need to have something like the space mission to spawn some of these technologies. And so in theory, they can be done otherwise, but you end up having to solve all these unknown problems when you send something to space. And they're not things that companies or even researchers would necessarily choose to do unless they had some sort of inspiring goal that requires you to solve this problem.
In your field of expertise, geobiology, which kind of sounds weird to me because it's the study of rocks and life. They seem incongruent to me somehow, but we'll talk about that too. But in your field, what does this kind of exploration, this kind of a mission, do for your scientific field of study that might have taken years to take place had it not been for missions like this?
So the search for life on another planet challenges us to think about life differently. You brought up the question earlier about what if there's life that isn't like what we recognize. The last time we did some experiments to look for life on Mars was with the Viking missions in the mid-70s. And at that point, we thought that bacterial life had to use oxygen and produced, you know, certain compounds. And since then, we've learned that there are bacteria that live deep in the earth, kilometers down, miles down in the earth, that don't live on oxygen. They live on the reaction between water and minerals. And when you actually sort of stretch your mind and your ideas to think about things in a new way, when you come back to Earth and life here, you think about things in a different way as well.
We've been talking about how small things have to be made to fit into the package that is delivered to the surface of Mars on this Curiosity rover. But this Curiosity rover is bigger than anyone and than any of the other previous exploratory devices. How big is it?
Well, the eyes on its head are about 7 feet tall. And I mean the cameras, because we have to look through those eyes. That's
so
what we get.
So it's taller than your average Joe.
It could
play basketball for the Bobcats.
Well, it's a little slow.
That doesn't matter. So are they.
Yeah. And the body is sort of the size of a small car. And it's got a really tall clearance, though. It is several feet off the ground. It can go drive right over large rocks.
How fast is it?
It can go, I think it's about 100 yards in an hour.
But you don't want it to be too fast, because if it tips over, you're done.
It has a very wide wheelbase. It will not tip over unless we make a really big mistake.
And what is the power source for this device?
It uses the radioactive decay of plutonium.
So it's a nuclear reactor.
It's not a nuclear reactor. So a nuclear reactor is when you have elements that combine and create radioactivity. This is just a radioactive element that just decays through time. And that decay produces heat, and that heat is converted to electrical energy.
Had this mission crashed, would we have been guilty of spewing radioactivity across the face of Mars?
Not across the face of Mars. We would have in one very small place. So the actual amount of radioactive material is about the size of a vitamin, a large vitamin pill. So it's really a very small amount.
Wow. And that's enough to make this thing operate for how many years?
So the main mission is 2 years, but the way radioactivity works is every period of time you sort of lose half of it. So the amount of power we have now is the most we'll ever have, and it'll decay very slowly through time. And so we will have, if the rover keeps working, more than 10 years where we can really actively use the instruments. But in that time, we'll have sort of less and less power. We'll be able to do less and less each year.
And when it completely depletes, when it goes dark, is the little pellet in there still dangerous to life forms?
It would probably still have enough radioactivity that it would certainly damage people and larger animals. There are bacteria that live on the insides of nuclear reactors, and they repair their DNA so fast that they can live there. So there are life forms that it wouldn't hurt at all.
Really? Is it shielded so that if we were to encounter some sort of a life form, we would not damage it?
It is shielded, and it produces some radiation, but there's also a lot of radiation that gets to the surface of Mars. So we don't expect there to be any life forms that would actually encounter it.
Why not solar power?
Solar power is effective, but one of the problems is that to get a lot of power, you need very large solar panels. Mm-hmm. And we have the Kemen instrument we talked about before, and also SAM, which is sample analysis at Mars. Both of those instruments, and particularly the SAM, uses a lot of power. And so to be able to do these sort of fancy chemical analyses, the solar panels would have to be so big that they aren't actually practical.
Dr. Dawn Sumner is our guest, a geobiologist and a co-investigator of the Mars Science Laboratory, a long-term planner for the Curiosity mission, which is now on the surface of Mars, and about which we will talk some more in the next few minutes. Stay with us. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Broad Residency, a nonprofit enabling mission-driven professionals to transition into management careers in education and strengthen public schools so all students and teachers can succeed. More at managementthatmatters.org. Coming up at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, it's Friday. That means the news roundup, domestic news in hour one. President Barack Obama is elected for another term. The U.S. House stays Republican and the Senate gains 2 Democratic seats. And the focus turns to avoiding the fiscal cliff. Diane and a panel of journalists discuss the week's top national stories, what happened, and why. That's coming up at 10, right after Charlotte Talks. We'll get back to our conversation about the Mars rover in just a moment. But we did record this earlier this week, so we will not be able to take your phone calls this morning. Stay tuned. We're coming right back.
Paul Cardone, owner of Garage Door Guru in Charlotte, talks about underwriting on WFAE.
It's been a very solid business decision for me. Often throughout the day, I'll hear WFAE come up. Someone, either themselves, the person who made the call, or a relative, heard me somehow through WFAE, so it's a nice backdrop to what I do. If you're thinking about WFAE, you know, it makes a lot of sense.
For more information, email underwriting@WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Dawn Sumner is our guest, a geobiologist with the Department of Geology at the University of California, Davis, and who has the excitement of being part of the Mars Curiosity Exploration team with NASA. Aside from how will we know when we find life, if we find life? Do we anticipate that it's going to look like a microscopic organism on Mars, or it's detritus because it was there 100 million years ago, but it's not there now? How will we know?
That's a really difficult question. So if we actually got really lucky, there is life on Mars, it looks like life on Earth, and leaves some of the same signatures, then we'll have a high confidence that we've actually recognized life on Mars. But there are all these links that you in the chain to get to that conclusion. And so there is likely to be, if there was life on Mars, the signatures of that life are likely to be fairly controversial and difficult to identify.
Meaning what?
Maybe I should say inconclusive. So there are certain things that we see in rocks on Earth, fossils, that look like life, but there are also ways to make them with chemical reactions that don't involve life. And those are the types of things that microscopic life tends to make.
Could you uncover DNA, ancient DNA?
So DNA is a very reactive molecule. So one of the reasons it's useful is because it is involved in all these chemical reactions. So even on Earth, when we've had DNA for a long period of time, it's very rare to find it in the rock record because it's an unstable molecule and it breaks down into components. So even if there was DNA on Mars, it would be very, very difficult to find, particularly in old rocks.
Could you find fossils? Would it surprise you to find a fossil?
If they're fossils, it's possible we could find them, and it would be a very surprising, wonderful thing to do.
And controversial, it would seem to me. That would be Earth shattering.
Mars-shattering.
Mars-shattering, yes. How would that be viewed in the scientific community, do you think? And then how would that be viewed in the world at large?
So it depends a huge amount on the fossil. So this morning I saw a talk about a baby woolly mammoth that was fossilized. And if we saw something with legs and trunks and eyes, that's sort of there's a level of complexity that you know it's life.
But if you find a bacterium, Or a virus, or evidence that those things existed at some point.
Right. So then it's very difficult to tell whether something is actually life, because most bacteria are little spheres, or maybe they're sort of like little threads. They have a very simple morphology. And you can get a little droplet of something that has nothing to do with life that also makes a sphere, because it's just the way the physics works to round off corners. And so it becomes, at that point, so some spheres, for example, found in a meteorite from Mars, and some people propose that, well, maybe they're some sort of microbial fossil. But most of us in the community don't think that they were able to prove that it was a fossil. And the same thing often happens when you just see something that's very simple.
Mm-hmm. How have we ensured that if we find something like a bacterium, that, and it's active, that we didn't introduce it to the planet, either with this mission or another mission that has left things behind.
Right. So we landed far enough from any other missions that it's very unlikely that any bacteria we brought with us from those missions could actually be transported to our site. It's so dry and cold that that's unlikely to happen. So we did clean the spacecraft fairly well. It's difficult to sterilize it completely. And so it would depend on sort of how we found it. We don't actually have a microscope that could image the bacteria. If it happened to get into our instrument that measures organic compounds, we would see organic compounds that are characteristic of life on Earth. And we have various sort of, we call them check materials. So we can sort of check for contamination by analyzing things that we brought with us. And if we just found one detection of compounds that look like they're on Earth, we would be very suspicious that we brought them with us.
What will surprise you more, finding life or not finding it?
I don't expect to find life, even if it was present. It's a very, very difficult task. And so for this mission, we're not expecting to find evidence of life. We're really trying to understand whether or not life could have lived there.
Which will surprise you more, finding water or evidence of water or not finding?
We've already found evidence of water.
Ah.
So we knew when we chose the Gale landing site that water had flowed at the surface. And when we actually landed, we landed in a place where we saw rounded pebbles. And as we drove away from where we landed, we saw more and more of them. And these, to get rounded pebbles, when rocks break, they have sharp edges. But when they bang against each other over time, they turn nice and smooth, like a good skipping stone. And that really only happens when you have water moving the stones and they're beating against each other. And so we've found a whole lot of these rounded stones that we think were actually transported in a stream.
Well, let me change the question up a little bit and say what will surprise you more, finding water, not evidence of water, mm-hmm. but finding water, whether it's frozen or running under the surface, or not finding it?
So we won't find water running at the surface because it's too cold now. We can't detect it under the surface if it's more than a meter, and we think it's frozen well below a meter. We won't find evidence of like good liquid water. We may, however, find frost and water vapor. So some of the minerals have water in them, and when they warm up a little, they release that water, and it can freeze on the surface.
Well, I know that you're talking somewhere here, and I've got a note about it someplace about relative humidity. And if there's relative humidity in the air, or the atmosphere. I'm not sure it's air. I don't know what it is, but is there an atmosphere, right?
Yeah, there's a thin atmosphere.
Okay, so if there is relative humidity, that means there's water in the air.
There's a little bit, yeah. And so the relative humidity most of the time is very low, and the temperature is very cold. But in past missions, both the Phoenix mission that landed near the pole where there is water ice, and the Opportunity rover, they have actually seen some of that water condense out of the atmosphere onto the rover lander.
What is the atmosphere?
It has carbon dioxide, a little bit of nitrogen, some argon, a little bit of oxygen.
We call Mars the red planet. Is it red?
It is. And
why is it red?
It's from iron. And so right now the surface is really dry, but it has basically the same minerals you find in rust. And rust is red, and that's just a characteristic of iron. It's why our blood is red.
Why is the Earth not red? Well, maybe it is. If you scraped away all the vegetation and removed the water from the Earth, what would we look like?
That's actually hard to imagine.
Well, if climate change continues, you'll get a firsthand shot at looking at it.
We'll still have water. So our because we have so much life in vegetation, the organic carbon and the iron just sort of keep reacting with each other. It's like I said, that's sort of why our blood works. So there are places that are red in the desert.
So Venus isn't red. Why is Mars red and Venus isn't and the Earth isn't? And what does that say to you?
So I don't know why Venus isn't red particularly, but for Mars, it means the surface is oxidized. So iron is one of the most common elements in the solar system. And the fact that Mars is red means that the surface is really oxidized, which is one of the reasons that we think it might be very difficult to find evidence of life at the surface, is because that iron reacts with organic compounds and makes them sort of turn into carbon dioxide.
And we can only dig, what, a meter down with this device? Is that what you're telling me?
Actually, only 5 centimeters, a few inches, yeah.
Now, here's a silly question. Why don't we take explosive charges, grenades, something that we can launch from the rover, blow something up, penetrate the surface, and then move the rover to it to look into the crater that we've created? Is that something that's worthwhile doing?
It's certainly interesting. I haven't actually thought about doing that. We've talked about going to recent meteorite impacts on Mars, right, to expose some of the fresh rocks. So it matters a whole lot which rocks we look at, but that would certainly be something interesting. The community is very interested in actually sending a mission to Mars to bring samples back and getting the right samples to bring to Earth to study in our labs where we can do a whole lot more. That might actually be an interesting way to get fresh samples.
Is there danger in that? I mean, if there is life on Mars, if below the surface, and it's microscopic in nature, and it's not like what we have on Earth, or it is like what we have on Earth, and we bring it back, how do we make sure it doesn't get out?
Yeah, so we would certainly use containment facilities like we use for some of these really deadly diseases. And there's been a lot of talk about how you would actually do that effectively. The things that are really dangerous to humans and life on Earth are things that have evolved with us to take advantage of the chemistry that we do in our bodies. And so, for example, there are even animals that are closely related to us that have diseases that don't hurt people because that chemistry is a little different. So if you have Martian life that's very different from Earth-based life, it's actually pretty unlikely to pose a hazard to us, because the biochemistry would be different. It wouldn't actually survive well in our environment and in ourselves.
But we would also have no immunity to whatever it is, because
right,
we have no exposure to it. So
right,
how do we know beyond the shadow of a doubt that bringing something back from any other interplanetary body that may harbor some sort of life form that may be in hibernation because it doesn't have what it needs, mm-hmm, and what it needs is what we have, how do we know that that wouldn't cause something terrible to happen here?
Right. You don't know beyond a shadow of a doubt. And so what you have to do is take your best precautions. And I think we are quite a long ways from actually being able to do this.
Because we know that there are things that live deep in the oceans and deep in these craters that have volcanic activity that are alive in places that mm-hmm, we thought couldn't possibly have life on Earth. And we know that things hibernate. How do we know that if there wasn't some form of life on Mars when it was more hospitable, if it was more hospitable, wouldn't flourish in the Earth environment?
We don't, because we don't even know if there's life on Mars, let alone what it is. And so it's one of those interesting questions and sort of things that I really hope that particularly some of the young scientists grab onto and think of creatively. How do you actually evaluate that? How do you test that?
Suppose that this or some other planetary mission in the future discovers something valuable, either on the surface, because we're testing the chemistry of the soil, mm-hmm, on the surface, under the surface of Mars or some other meteorite that we, a comet that we travel to, because I know we're planning to go to a meteorite, aren't we, or something like that? Would there be any questions asked about the morality of then using that planet or that object in the sky as a mine for Earth?
Right. So I think that they're very, very important questions about that in terms of morality. We have right now it's so expensive to get to these other planets, let alone bring something back to Earth, that I think we have a long time to address those sorts of questions. Of sort of possibly more immediate moral question is, for example, the human spaceflight. When we send a rover to Mars, we can do a lot to clean it, and it's not entirely sterile, but it's mostly sterile. If we actually send people to another planet, like we sent people to the moon, those environments can't be sterile because we depend on bacteria. There are more bacterial cells in our bodies than there are human cells. And so this whole question about the possibility of taking Earth life and contaminating other bodies in the solar system is a moral question we have to deal with right now.
What's going to make your day as a geobiologist as this mission unfolds? What's going to make your day?
I've already had several days made, and the first telephoto image I saw of Mount Sharp, which is in Gale Crater, I've studied so many times from orbiters. The first time I saw this high-resolution color image from the ground, I burst into tears, and I still sometimes tear up when I see this image.
Because?
It is so beautiful. It's as beautiful as any of the national parks on Earth. And the whole sense that there's another planet that is so beautiful and people are there. We can virtually there. We can look at it. We can explore it. There's something that's just so exciting, the sense of exploration, the sense of discovery, that you know, it's just a picture, but it's such a picture.
And you want to be there, though. Wish you were there.
I kind of like Earth.
Dr. Don Sumner, geobiologist in the Department of Geology, University of California, Davis, and also long-term planner for the Curiosity mission to Mars. Thank you for the hour.
Thank you very much.